anybody. But here's something I found that says, why men are proud of themselves. And ladies, you won't appreciate this, but in a way you will. Because they're basically comparing men with women and why men are proud of themselves. Here's one of them. A 5-day trip requires only one suitcase. We can open all our own jars. We can go to the bathroom without a support group. I like that one. We can kill our own food. I'm skipping a bunch. Oh, if someone forgets to invite us to something, they can still be our friend. That one must have hit a nerve, huh? Everything on our faces stays the original color. Three pair of shoes are more than enough. We don't have to clean the house if the meter reader is coming. Car mechanics tell us the truth. We can sit quietly and watch a game with a friend for hours without thinking, he must be mad at me. We can drop by and see a friend without having to bring a little gift. If another guy shows up at a party in the same outfit, you just might become lifelong friends. How's that? Your pals never trap you with, so, notice anything different? The same hairstyle lasts for years, maybe decades. One wallet, one pair of shoes, one color, all seasons. We can do our nails with a pocket knife. And Christmas shopping can be accomplished for 25 people on the day before Christmas in 45 minutes. Gentlemen, that should tell you why you should appreciate your wife. Really. You know, we're looking at the marriage relationship, and we want to get first things first. We want to get second things second. So to do a little bit of review here, if I say first things first, I am talking about my relationship with my God. Okay, that's first things first. And for those of you who haven't been here, that's number one. And fathers, your relationship with God must be first. It's not your wife. It's not your children. It's your relationship with God. We have that little tract that says, how would you describe your relationship with God? And that's the same thing that I could ask each of you men this morning. How would you describe your relationship with God? You would say, well, I'm a Christian. That's good. Now, as a Christian, how would you describe your relationship with God? Are you walking closely with Him? Are you reading His Word? Are you staying in fellowship with Him? Because that's more important than any other relationship, is your relationship with God. First things first. Now, second things second. You see, if that's right, if my vertical relationship is right, then secondly, my relationship with my spouse. You see, if my relationship with God is right, then and only then can my relationship with my spouse be right. Because if either myself or my wife is out of relationship or out of fellowship with God, it's going to affect our relationship with each other. Especially if the other is walking with the Lord. So second things second. And that's where we are now. We're going to get the third things third. That's my relationship with my children. But we better get this right first. Because only when our relationship with God is right, and then secondly with our spouse, then thirdly can we have a proper relationship with our kids. But let's get first things first, and second things second. As we looked at Matthew chapter 19, and we looked at verses 1 through 6, we saw there that marriage is ordained by God. And that the most precious gift that parents can give their children is to love and live with each other. Because the most basic relationship, the most basic family relationship is not the parent-child relationship, but the husband-wife relationship. So marriage is ordained by God. Secondly, marriage is ordered by God. And we saw three things under that. We saw the role of the wife last week. And her role is determined by the order in the formation. And I simply use the word formation in the place of creation because formation starts with an F and this is alliterated. So it's the order of formation. But I also use the word that Paul uses to Timothy when he says Adam was first formed. Secondly, the order in the fall. Who fell first? Adam was not deceived, but the woman, Paul says. And then the order given in the figure in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 22 to 33. You may have turned to Matthew 19, but I'd like you to go to Ephesians chapter 5. That's where we're going to be this morning. The order in the figure. And in the figure, as Paul is relating the relationship between Christ and the church, he says that this is a figure of the relationship of the husband with his wife. And so we saw the role of the wife last Sunday. This morning we're going to look at the role of the husband. Very briefly, what is the role of the wife? Verse 22, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. And I acknowledged last week that that is not popular today, even among some Christians. That word submit is a dirty word. And it bespeaks to some people of somebody who is allowing themselves to be trampled upon. But the Bible says, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. But now, fathers, I'm speaking to you today. Do you make it easy for your wife to submit? And that's what we're going to be looking at. You are responsible for headship. You are to be the head. It says in verse 23, for the husband is what? The head of the wife. Let me ask you something. Which is more difficult? Submission or headship? Well, it may depend upon the circumstance. Submission is certainly hard because the inner person rebels. But notice what is required of husbands here. It is headship. And I'm not only speaking to the fathers here, I'm speaking to young men. Men who are not married, young boys. Because one day, if the Lord so leads that you get married, you remember this message. If it's 5 years from now or 7 or 10 years from now, you are to be the head. You are to be the head. It is one thing to exemplify the church in her relationship to Jesus Christ. A relationship that ought to be perfect, but is far from it. We read on, verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. So you see the example. You see the pattern that a man is to follow, and that he, the Lord Jesus Christ, is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so here's the pattern, here's the example. As the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in some things. Anybody awake? Anybody awake? In everything. But now, husbands, love your wives. You would say, well, why do I need to be commanded to do that? Well, let me ask you this. Why do you have to be commanded to love God? I say again, it is one thing to exemplify the church and her relationship to Christ, a relationship that ought to be perfect but is far from it. But the relationship of Christ to the church as the head is perfect. And that's what the husband's supposed to exemplify. You see, the church to Christ is imperfect because we are sinners. But Christ's relationship to us, does he ever fail us? Never. And so to exemplify that to a man ought to bring you to the place where you go, boy, I fail all the time. Because I see the perfect example. Christ's authority in the home is centered in the husband, not in the wife, not in the children. He ought to be the spiritual leader. It's sad that in many homes, the spiritual leader has to be the wife. It's even more sad when the children are in control. And you can tell what homes are like that. Guess who mostly contacts me when a family's looking for a church? Would you think it's the husband or would you think it's the wife? Okay, heads bowed, eyes closed. I know we did this last week, but I'm taking a poll. This is a scientific poll. Heads bowed, eyes closed, no one looking around. Who do you think will contact me? And it happened just happened this last week. Who do you think is going to contact me, the husband or the wife, when it comes time to find a church? If you vote for the husband, raise your hand. He's taking the lead. If you think it's the wife, typically raise your hand. Okay, you may put your hands, then you may look up here. Not a one, said the husband. Folks, that is sad. And most of you see it. That is sad. Somebody emailed me and asked me all kinds of theological questions. It was the wife doing it. And then followed upon with more doctrinal questions. Who's the head? Now, if the husband truly delegated it to her, that's one thing. But even then, I would think he would be the one asking the doctrinal questions. The headship of Christ over the church is seen in Ephesians 1:22. Would you go back there, just a page back in my Bible? It says there in Ephesians 1:22, "And hath put all things under his feet and gave him to be the head over all things to the church." Verse 23, "The church is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all." So the metaphor being used here is that the church is the body, Jesus Christ is the head. And if the husband is to parallel Christ and the church, this is how he exercises his leadership. "God hath put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things." In other words, and I'm quoting somebody here, all things that have been given to Jesus Christ are given to him for his church. And he exercises headship over his church for her blessing, for her benefit, and for her good. His headship is a headship oriented toward the church. The church is his body. The head feeds the body, nourishes the body, and cares for the body. The head does not run off on its own, but the head is always concerned about the body. Go back to Ephesians chapter 5. Let's read on. We read verse 25. "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself." You never see anywhere in the Bible where God is saying, you know, men, you need more self-esteem. You need to love yourself more. It's never in there. It's always, you need to love your wife. Why? The man already loves himself. Where do you see that? Verse 28, "So men ought to love their wives as their own bodies." They already love themselves. "He that loveth his wife loveth himself." Now, note verse 29, "For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church." So men, being the head, implies love for the body, the giving of oneself. And so I say again that the best gift that a father can give his children is to be a good husband to their mother. And that requires an ongoing relationship. But if you listen to the U.S. Census Bureau, they say that about 20% of the country's two-parent, two-income households with children are tag-team families. You know what a tag-team family is? A tag-team family is where the parents want to ensure that the kids are always with at least one parent. And so to avoid putting their kids in daycare and so forth, by working split shifts and handing off kids, to avoid being away from the kids, the parents miss each other by having split shifts. So then at least one of them is seeing the child. Well, who's not seeing each other? The parents don't see each other, and the marital bond is endangered. I say again that if you're going to have an ongoing relationship where the husband is being the father that he needs to be and being a good husband, that ongoing relationship is necessary, and that requires sacrifice. And a husband, a father who honors God, will sacrifice. Two things I want to point out here. The sacrifice, number one, of loving. The sacrifice of loving. The Bible speaks of love as a commandment to obey. So if it's a command, you have a decision to make. You can either obey or disobey. So it's a decision you make. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. It's a decision you need to make. And we see here, husbands, verse 25, love your wives. That's a commandment. The command to love is addressed to husbands. The command addressed to the wives in this passage is to submit. If there's going to be love in the home, it must start with the husband. He is to love his wife as Christ loves his bride, the church. And if I'm going to follow Jesus' example, I have to take the initiative on the love part. It used to be that the guy would pursue the girl. More and more we're seeing the other side taking place, where girls are starting to pursue guys. Now, the picture is where the guy displays his love. We, the church, we, the bride, love him. Why? Because he first loved. You see, who took the initiative? And so, men, it is our responsibility to take the initiative. And you say, well, man, there's no submission of my wife. Well, maybe it's because there's no love being shown by the husband. You say, we're no longer in love. Why is that? Who made the decision to stop loving? Well, we fell into love once. Now, love is not something you fall into. Something is love that you choose to do. Even when you fall into it, you chose to do it. And it is also something that many people cease choosing to do. I've got an article here. My wife has probably been looking for it. You've been looking for that article? She has been. I saw it laying out one day, so I picked it up and brought it to the church. Sorry, I didn't tell you about that, hon. It is a story that is fascinating. It was in the Parade magazine, July 30th, 2000. Let me just read you the byline up here that tells you what the gist of the story is. Richie was her first passionate love, the man with whom she'd vowed to share her future. But when she learned he was dead, Betty Schimmel agreed to marry another man who adored her. Then one day, she met Richie again. You see, this took place back before World War II. Betty Schimmel was 9 years old when she met Richie. Hitler was marching through Europe. She was in Czechoslovakia. She had to flee to the country of Hungary. As they became teenagers, their friendship turned to love. They planned their wedding when she was just 15. And they said that they would always have the reception at the Hotel Royal, where the Nazis were now occupying. But then they got separated in the fall of 1944. You see, the Nazis rounded up Betty, a Jew, and Richie, a Jew. And they were separated. And so the Nazis rounded up Betty, her mother, her sister, her brother, herded them along with others, 5,000 of them, to a concentration camp. And she was one of the 500 survivors out of the 5,000. After she got out of there, when the Americans saved her in the May of 1945, she said, I was just happy to be alive. She was 16 years old. And for the next year, she went from camp to camp looking for Richie. The only thing she found was a list that said he was dead. She was heartbroken. But her mom urged her, you know what, you've got to go on. You've got to move on. And there was a young man who was very interested in Betty. His name was Otto. Otto had lost his entire family at Auschwitz. But Betty had told him, I'll marry you, but I don't love you. She told him that. They got married. They had children, moved to the United States. In 1975, it says Betty decided to go back to Hungary for the first time since the war. So she went back to Hungary. And that first week when she was there, she said that they were in a vehicle and they just happened to pull up to the Hotel Royale where she had planned her wedding with Richie. She went in there and it was toward the end of dinner that she looked across the room and then she stared. I knew it was Richie just from the back of his head. The man she thought had died, her love from childhood. She walked up to him, touched him on the elbow and said, do you know who I am? He stood up and immediately hugged her. They had just a matter of hours to catch up and decide their future. She was married. He was married with kids. Richie told Betty how that the Nazis had captured him toward the end of the war, sent him to a forced labor camp in Hungary. He was liberated 2 months later, and he began his search for Betty. For 15 years, he remained unmarried, waiting for her. But Richie had married with 3 children. And now, as he's standing there with his childhood sweetheart, he begged her to leave her family and stay with him. Now, remember, Betty did not love Otto, and she told him that. It was raining that night in Budapest as Betty walked with Richie. I looked up into his beautiful blue eyes and I saw reflected there our boat trips on the Danube and all the love we'd shared. But I also heard my mother's voice reminding me of the importance of family. And I saw Otto working 18 hours a day out of love for us. She said, I told Richie I would give him my answer the next morning at our favorite meeting spot. She said, pacing in her hotel room, Betty finally made her choice. I left Richie a note that was a goodbye. The next morning, I cried all the way to Vienna. The day after, I cried all the way to Paris. In Paris, Otto was waiting for me. I told him I was coming home with him, and for the first time, I allowed myself to love him for himself. She chose to love the one who had all those years shown love to her. I can't imagine what it was like to be Otto for all those years, displaying love and never having that reciprocated. Can you imagine? But men, that's what we do, is we choose to love. And I thought that was a great illustration of exactly what that is, what that means. You know what? The day you got married, you made vows. Why do you make vows on the wedding day? Because that day the emotions are high. And you're like, man, she's the one, and I will never, and you say this in your vows, I will never leave you. And then you say all those things, sickness and health, rich for poor, and so forth and so on. And so you make your vows when the emotions are high, so that when they're not as high, you stay committed because you said yes. And you don't back out because of expediency. But folks, we live in a day when people are unwilling to make commitments, and that's why they live together in sin before they're married. Read Hebrews 13:5 sometimes, what God thinks of anybody living together, a couple living together before they're married. He calls them whoremongers. But today we live when people aren't willing to make commitments. And when they do make commitments, what do? They back out. Has anybody ever been told, I will meet you at such and such a place, and then the person simply decides not to be there? Has that ever happened to you? It used to be that a man would say, if I'm going to be somewhere, we would say his word is his. It's his bond and he will do it. Today, you've got to sign papers and you've got to have 20 pages of somebody's signature before they stay committed. And even then, they're not committed. And they think nothing of it. Jesus said, let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. You know what he's talking about there? He's saying, when you say yes, mean it. And if you say no, mean it. You shouldn't have to stand there and say, no, I swear, I promise. Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. You don't have to say that. You said yes, so be there, do it. James goes on to say in chapter 5 and verse 12, but above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea and your nay, nay, lest ye fall into condemnation. I'll visit somebody and I'll say, I'll see you in church this Sunday, right? Yes. No. Will I see you in church this Sunday? You will see me. This happened just a couple of weeks ago. I will be there Wednesday night, and if I'm not, I will call you. Guess what? They weren't here and they didn't call. Because I was trying to help them. It's tragic when a believer in a private conversation has to say this, I swear. You should never have to say that. People ought to know enough of you that when you say something, you know what? I can leave and I know what's going to happen. When something is delegated to you, it ought to be where your employer can go think about something else and completely forget about it, knowing that you're going to take care of it. But folks, that can't even happen here. Somebody will say, you know what, I'll do such and such, Pastor, I'll do. And there are some here I know I can count on. If they say they're going to do it, I know it. And I can. And there's some of you who are in positions of leadership here where you can delegate something to somebody, and when they say they're going to do it, you know they're going to do it. You don't have to think a thing about it. But there are some where, you know, I'm going to have to check up on it, make sure it got done. Make sure they showed up, make sure they did it the way they said they were going to do it. That ought not so to be. There's times when a vow or an oath in public is necessary because there are some people present who don't know you. And that's why you may have to put your hand on a Bible and take an oath and say, I promise to tell the truth, nothing but the truth, and so forth and so on. Jesus is not saying that's not something we can do. We can't do. That's in public. But folks, in private conversation as a believer, you ought to be able to say something and people know you're going to do it. Now, let's get back to what we're talking about. Fathers, you made a marriage vow. You gave your word. Love is not a prerequisite for marriage. Love is an obligation for marriage. So there's the sacrifice of loving. Secondly, there's the sacrifice of giving. At times in marriage, one of the two becomes unlovable. Bow your heads, close your eyes. No, I'm not going to ask you. One of the two becomes unlovable. How then do you love, husbands? Well, was there ever a time when God loved you when you were unlovable? Love begins with giving, and giving is something you decide to do. Romans 12:21 says, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. And you can quote with me John 3:16, just the first part of it. For God so loved the world that he... That's the expression of love. It's giving. Galatians 2:20. Who loved me and gave himself for me, speaking of Jesus Christ. Romans 5:8, but God commended his love toward us, in that while we're yet sinners, Christ died for me. He gave himself for me. And here in Ephesians 5:25, Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. I've told you what my pastor told me in front of the witnesses the day we got married, the same thing he told Juanita. Do you remember this? Dan, you are not today getting a wife. You are giving Juanita a husband. It's giving. Juanita, you are not today getting a husband. You are giving to Dan a wife. And so we need to look at our relationships as not getting but giving. And even when you join this church, it's not a getting relationship, it's a giving relationship. And what a blessing when people give. I'm not talking about financially. I'm talking about giving of yourselves. And I could start, but if I start, I'd have to mention everybody who gives so sacrificially here. I mean, even yesterday, people giving of themselves. Some may say about their church, you know what, I'm not getting enough here. That may not be the problem. The problem may be I'm not giving enough. And we often discover, you will often discover that those who like to get but don't like to give are the same way in their marriage. And if you look at their past, they've either left a spouse or in some cases they're about to leave a spouse. Because their whole philosophy is getting, not giving. Now, I want to close with this example in Genesis 18. Speaking to fathers. Genesis chapter 18. God knew that a certain man would lead his family. You know what I'm talking about? Genesis 18:19. It says in verse 18, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. It's a question, but he says in verse 19, for I know him, that he will command his children. I know him. God knew that Abraham would lead his family, and as the head of the home, Abraham was responsible for the discipline of his children. That word command, that's a strong word. God knew that he would do what with his children? Command them, but not just his children, but his household. God knew that Abraham would command. God expects you fathers to use authority over your children. Everything today is a democracy. And so modern parents today think that when the baby is born and you bring him or her home, a new voter has arrived. That's really the way it happens. They allowed the child to vote by allowing him to have what he wants instead of what he needs. Let me tell you something. Your child is not a voter. If you're the commander, as Abraham, God knew him to be, then the child doesn't get a vote. He is told what to do. But a good father is not just someone who goes around giving orders. Notice that God says he knows that Abraham will command his children to do what? To keep the way of the Lord. That's what he's going to command his children to do. In other words, he has an agenda. And his main priority is not that the child keeps mama's way or teacher's way or a friend's way or even his own way, but that the child keeps the way of the Lord. And the verse goes on to say that Abraham will command his children to keep the way of the Lord to do what? To do justice and judgment. That's the outcome. That's the action. I read an article by John Ashbrook called The Government of the Home. This is back in 2006. He said this: every child has all the essential ingredients for being a slob. And they do. I did. All that you have to do if you wish your children to be adult slobs is to just let them grow up. They have all the natural talent. And I think every parent can testify to that. But he goes on to a section entitled, Be in Command in Teaching Manners. Now listen, if your children have table manners, it will be because you determined to teach them. You know that doesn't happen by accident. If your children know how to conduct themselves in someone else's home or in church without running where they ought not, it will be because you commanded them. But it is amazing how many little kids rule the roost today. If your children have respect for adults and the elderly, it will be because you required that. My dad taught me when I was a kid, you ever go to someone who's older than you, it's Mr. or it's Mrs. or it's Miss. You never call somebody by their first name. So I began to work for Mr. Stuckey. I was 15 or 16. And it drove Mr. Stuckey crazy. He wanted me to call him Dale. And I couldn't do it. Because my dad had told me, no, you're Mr. Stuckey. He was a farmer. And I couldn't do it. Because my dad had commanded me. If your children have respect for the property of others, it will be because you taught that. Our civilized society has become an uncivilized society because parents have not commanded their children. Dads, this is what God said about Abraham. I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment. God knew that of Abraham. Now, how would you describe Isaac? How would you describe Isaac, whom Abraham commanded on the day that Abraham took him to Mount Moriah, and Isaac was saying, Dad, where's the sacrifice? God's going to provide a lamb. Have you ever thought of what was going through Isaac's mind as Dad took him upon the mountain and laid him upon the altar and bound him to the altar and raised his knife? You read nothing of Isaac struggling and fighting. There was a child who was surrendered to his dad. Why? Because dad commanded him. And then you get to Genesis chapter 24. And Father Abraham tells his servant, I want you to go out and find a wife for my son. How many of you guys would like that? And you don't hear anything about Isaac rebelling. That's not that we do that today. I do think a child ought to respect his parents when they say, you know what, she's not good for you. But you don't read anything about Isaac getting upset when Rebekah came. Took her in and chose to love her. Dads, your role is that of leading, commanding, being the head. But you cannot do that if you are not surrendered to the Lord. You must be surrendered first. Lord, I pray that every man here would be totally surrendered to you. I pray that every